Welcome to Base by Base, your shortcut to being well-informed. This time, we're looking closely at some new research, something that could really make a difference for people with a specific genetic disorder.
That's right. We're talking about classical homocystinuria, or HCU for short.
And the paper we're digging into today was just published in Genetics and Medicine in 2025.
Yep. It's titled, Safety and Efficacy of Pegtibatinase Enzyme Replacement Therapy in Adults with Classical Homocystinuria in the COMPOSE Phase 12 Randomized Trial. The first author is Kan Fichikioglu, along with his colleagues.
Okay, so before we get into the study itself, maybe set the stage for us. What exactly is HCU, and why is new research like this so important?
Right. So HCU is a pretty serious inherited condition. It happens because an enzyme, cystathionine beta synthase, or CBS, isn't working properly.
CBS. Got it. And what does that enzyme normally do?
It's absolutely key for breaking down an amino acid called methionine. So when CBS is deficient, you get this harmful buildup of something called total homocysteine THCD and also methionine itself in the blood and tissues.
And I imagine that buildup isn't good news for the body.
Not at all. High THC is, well, it's toxic. It can cause a whole range of severe problems across different body systems. Things like dangerous blood clots, strokes, vision problems like dislocated lenses, skeletal issues, and even significant cognitive impairment.
Wow. That sounds incredibly challenging to live with.
It really is. If it's not treated effectively, the outlook isn't great. It often leads to progressive disability and, unfortunately, reduced lifespan.
So effective treatment is critical. What's currently available for people with HCU?
The standard treatments have been around for a while. They mainly involve very strict low-protein diets, often needing special metabolic formulas to limit methionine intake, plus supplements like vitamin B6 and another substance called betaine.
And how well do those manage to control the THC levels? Is it enough?
Well, that's the core problem, really. There's a big unmet need here. The goal is to get THC levels down, ideally below 100 micromolar to reduce major risk, or even better, below 50, closer to the normal range, which is like 10-15. But even with diet and current therapies, many people just can't get their levels down that low. Studies show average levels often stay way above target, sometimes over 110 micromolar. It's just incredibly difficult to manage, especially with the diet.
Right. Adherence must be a huge challenge. So there's definitely room for improvement. And that brings us to this study and pegtibatinase. What's the idea behind this new drug?
Pegtibatinase is what's called an enzyme replacement therapy. The basic idea is simple. If the body's own enzyme is missing or faulty, you provide a working version.
So you're replacing the defective CBS enzyme.
Exactly. It's a specially engineered version of the human CBS enzyme. It's been modified pegylated, actually, to make it more stable and last longer in the bloodstream. The goal is for it to act like a metabolic sink, pulling that excess THC out of the tissues and breaking it down.
Ah, okay. So tackling the root cause, biochemically speak.
Precisely. And the hope is if you can control the THC levels effectively, you can potentially prevent or lessen those severe complications we talked about.
Makes sense. And this specific paper reports on the COMPOSE trial, right? The first big test in humans.
Yes, it's the phase 12 trial. So focusing primarily on safety, is the drug tolerated? And also getting an early look at efficacy, does it actually work to lower THC in adults with HCU who still had high levels despite standard care?
All right, let's get into the nitty-gritty then. How did they set up this COMPOSE trial? What was the design?
Okay, so the paper describes it as an ongoing study run at multiple centers. It's a phase 12, double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial, and it involved dose escalation.
Whoa, okay, let's unpack that a bit. Phase 12 means early stage, looking at safety and initial effectiveness.
Correct. Double-blind means neither the participants nor the investigators knew who was getting the actual drug versus a placebo, a dummy treatment.
Right, to avoid bias.
Randomized means people were assigned by chance to either the drug or placebo group. And dose escalation means they started with lower doses and gradually increased them in different groups or cohorts of participants to find a safe and effective range.
Okay, that sounds like a rigorous way to start testing a new therapy. Who were the participants?
They recruited people aged 12 to 65 who had a confirmed HCU diagnosis, you know, through genetic testing. And importantly, their THC levels had to be elevated at the start of the study despite being on their usual treatments.
And how were they assigned?
They used a 3-to-1 randomization. So for every 4 participants, 3 got pegtibatinase and 1 got placebo. The treatment was given as an injection under the skin subcutaneous twice a week.
Twice weekly. And they tested different dose levels.
Yes, 6 different dose cohorts, starting low and going up to the highest dose tested, which was 2.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight twice weekly, or 2.5 milligram kilogram BIW as they write it.
How did they land on that 2.5 millikilokero dose? Was it based on earlier work?
Absolutely. It came from preclinical studies looking at pharmacology and, crucially, safety in animal models, particularly non-human primates. They identified a dose level in animals where no adverse effects were seen, the NOA eel.
Ah, the no observed adverse effect level.
Right. And the 2.5 millijek and beculo dose in humans was well below that, providing a good safety margin based on the animal data.
Okay, good to know there was preclinical backing.
Yeah.
Now, about that double blinding, You mentioned the drug solution might look different from placebo. How did they handle that? Seems tricky.
Yeah, that can be a challenge. What they did was have specific, unblinded site staff, like pharmacists, prepare the doses. These staff members knew who was getting what, but they weren't involved in assessing the participants' outcomes at all.
I see.
They'd prepare the injection, maybe mask it somehow, so that the person administering it and the participant and the doctors evaluating them all remain blind to the treatment assignment.
Clever solution.
Uh-huh.
So, who exactly were they looking for? Any other key criteria for getting into the study?
Besides the confirmed HCU diagnosis, age, and the elevated THC, yes. For most cohorts, that baseline THC had to be 80 micromolar or more.
Okay.
But for the final highest dose cohort, cohort 6, they actually lowered that entry threshold a bit to 50 micromolar or more, provided the person had a history of levels over 80.
Why did they do that?
Likely to see if the drug could also benefit people with slightly less severe elevations, maybe broadening the potential patient group if it worked well. Also, participants needed to be on stable standard of care treatments and diets before and during the study. That's key.
Right. So you can see the drug's effect on top of current care.
Exactly. And standard exclusions applied to, like, allergies to the drug components, recent use of similar pegylated drugs, organ transplants, pregnancy, things like that.
Makes sense. So they've got their participants, their doses, their blinding.
Mm-hmm.
What were they actually measuring? What were the goals, the endpoints?
The primary focus, being phase 12, was safety. So they tracked all adverse events, any side effects. They monitored standard lab tests, blood counts, liver function, kidney function, etc. And they also looked closely at immunogenicity.
Immunogenicity. So whether the body develops an immune reaction, like antibodies, against the drug.
Precisely. That's always a consideration with biologic therapies like enzyme replacements.
Mm-hmm.
Does the body see it as foreign and try to attack it?
Okay, safety first. And then for efficacy, how did they tell if it was actually working on the HCU itself?
They looked at the biochemistry. They measured the plasma concentrations of those key metabolites in the methionine cycle every 2 weeks. Total homocysteine, THC was the big one, obviously.
Yeah.
But also methionine, total cysteine, cystathionine, which is the product of the CBS enzyme, and others like SAH and SAM. Tracking all of these gives you a much fuller picture of whether that metabolic pathway is actually being fixed.
Got it. A comprehensive look at the metabolic effects. Now, these are rare diseases, so participant numbers are usually small. How do they handle the data analysis?
Good point. They noted that for early phase studies in rare diseases, having about 3 participants on the active drug per dose cohort is generally considered acceptable for getting initial safety and efficacy signals.
Okay.
For the analysis, they included everyone who got at least 1 dose, the safety analysis set. And to handle the expected variability, especially with small numbers, they used the geometric mean rather than a simple average to summarize the results for each cohort.
The geometric mean. That helps reduce the impact of outliers, right? Makes the average more stable.
Exactly. They specifically used the geometric mean of the metabolite levels measured during the later part of the double-blind period, like weeks 6 through 12, to assess the treatment effect.
Okay, that sounds statistically sound for this situation. All right, we've got the setup. Let's move on to the findings. What did they actually see? How many people took part?
So they screened 28 individuals, and 24 were ultimately randomized and included in the analysis. Pretty much all of them, 23 out of 24, completed the 12-week double-blind phase. Only 1 person discontinued, and that was due to a leg fracture totally unrelated to the study drug.
Good completion rate, then. What were these participants like at the start, at baseline?
The average age was just under 24. About a third were adolescents, aged 12 to 17, mostly male, about 75%, and predominantly white participants. And importantly, almost all were already on standard HCU treatments.
Like the betaine and B6 you mentioned.
Yeah, over 90% were taking betaine, about 60% were on vitamin B6, and two-thirds were using metabolic formulas as part of their diet.
Okay, so a treated population. But despite that, what were their THC levels like?
Still high. The overall geometric mean baseline THCC across all participants was 135.5 micromolar. Remember those targets, below 100, ideally below 50. So these are definitely people who needed better control.
Clearly. Okay, so how did they fare on the treatment? Let's talk safety first. How well was pegtibatinase tolerated?
Overall, the report says it was generally well tolerated across all the dose levels, right up to the highest one. And really importantly, there were no cases of anaphylaxis, that severe immediate allergic reaction, or other severe immune
That's
reactions.
very reassuring for a new biologic drug.
It is. It's a positive sign for potential long-term use.
Were there any side effects, though? Any adverse events?
Yes, there were. Treatment-related adverse events, TEAEs, were seen more often in the groups getting pegtibatinase compared to placebo. About two-thirds of those on the drug had at least one TSE versus half in the placebo group.
But did anyone have to stop the drug because of side effects?
No, the paper states that no participants discontinued treatment due to a TEAE.
Okay, that's also good news. What kinds of side effects were they seeing most commonly?
The most frequent were injection site reactions, things like redness, itching, or swelling where the shot was given. That's pretty common with subcutaneous injections. These were generally reported as mild.
Understandable. Any other notable side effects?
Yes, the other treatment-related TEAEs seen in more than one person were urticaria, which is hives, and some joint pain, arthralgia.
Hives. Okay. Was that serious?
There is one case classified as a serious TEAE. It was acute urticaria in someone in one of the lower dose cohorts, but it resolved completely, and that participant was actually able to restart the drug later without the hives recurring.
Interesting. And you mentioned hives in the highest dose cohort, too.
Yes, two participants in cohort 6 experienced moderate urticaria, but it wasn't deemed serious. In these cases, they managed it effectively.
How did they manage it?
They temporarily paused the dosing, maybe gave some pre-medication like an antihistamine when restarting, and then gradually increased the dose back up to the target level. And using that approach, both participants were able to get to and stay on the full 2.5 milligram kilogram dose.
Okay, so it sounds like even when these immune-type reactions, like hives, occurred, they were generally manageable with adjustments. What about those antibodies you mentioned earlier, the immunogenicity?
Right. They did detect anti-drug antibodies, or ADAs, in a fair number of participants over time. Somewhere between 55% and 80% developed them when followed out to 48 months in the extension phase.
That sounds like a lot. Was it a problem?
Well, the paper emphasizes that the levels or titers of these antibodies were mostly low or they were transient, meaning they didn't stick around long. They also looked at antibodies to the PEG component of the drug. Those increased initially, but then actually seemed to decrease over time below baseline levels even.
Oh, why would that happen?
The author suggested this might indicate some kind of tolerization, the immune system maybe getting used to the PEG molecule over time.
And the crucial question, did having these antibodies stop the drug from working?
That's the key point. According to the results, the presence of these antibodies, whether against the drug or the PEG, didn't seem to have any negative impact on the drug's ability to lower THC levels or its pharmacokinetics.
That's really significant. Sometimes antibodies can completely neutralize these kinds of therapies.
Exactly. So finding no impact here is a very positive sign for durability.
Okay, so summing up the safety. Generally well-tolerated, manageable side effects, mainly mild ISRs or manageable urticaria, no severe immune events, and antibodies didn't seem to block the effect. Sounds pretty promising on the safety front.
Agreed. For an early phase trial, that's a good profile.
Now let's get to the main event, efficacy. Did it actually lower the homocysteine levels?
Yes, and this is where the results get quite striking. They saw really substantial reductions in THCs, but it was clearly dose dependent. The major effects were seen in the two highest dose cohorts, cohort 5 getting 1.5 millikilograms, and cohort 6 getting 2.5 milligrams, both twice weekly.
How substantial are we talking? Give us the numbers.
Okay, so compared to their baseline levels, the geometric mean THC in cohort 5 dropped by 57.1%. In cohort 6, the highest dose, it dropped by 67.1%.
Wow, over 50 and nearly 70% reduction. That's huge. What about the placebo group?
Minimal change. Their geometric mean THC actually went up by about 0.6%, and the lower dose cohorts 1 through 4 showed much smaller reductions or basically no change.
So a clear dose response, The higher the dose, the bigger the drop in THC.
Definitely.
How quickly did these reductions happen? Was it a slow process?
No, it was rapid. The paper highlights that in those top two cohorts, the average THC levels fell to or below that important 100 micromolar threshold within just 2 weeks of starting treatment.
2 weeks, that's fast.
And importantly, those levels remain suppressed, staying at or below 100 micromolar throughout the entire 12-week double-blind period. It was a sustained effect.
And hitting that under 100 mark is clinically really important, right, for reducing long-term risks.
Yeah, absolutely. That's considered a key therapeutic goal. And maybe the most remarkable finding here was that every single participant in both cohort 5 and cohort 6 achieved a post-treatment THC level below 100 micromolar.
Everyone. That's impressive, getting 100% response on that measure.
It really is, especially considering these were people who weren't well controlled on standard care.
Did anyone get their levels even lower, closer to the normal range?
Yes. In the highest dose cohort, cohort 6, two of the participants got their THC below the 50 micromolar threshold, and one participant actually achieved a level below 15 micromolar, which puts them right into the normal range.
Into the normal range.
Yeah.
That's fantastic for that individual. Okay, what about the other metabolites? Did they see changes there too?
They did, and the patterns really support the idea that the enzyme replacement was working as intended. Methionine levels, which are also typically high in HCU, showed even more dramatic reductions.
Really? How much did methionine drop?
In cohort 5, the average methionine went from about 670 micromolar at baseline down to 67. That's a 90% reduction. In cohort 6, their baseline was lower, around 138, but it dropped to 37, a 73% reduction, landing them well within the normal range as a group.
Okay, so it's tackling both the high homocysteine and the high methionine.
Yes. And other changes fit the picture, too. They saw increases in cysteine and, significantly, in cystathionine.
Why is cystathionine significant?
Because cystathionine is the direct product of the CBS enzyme reaction. Seeing it go up suggests the replacement enzyme is actively working, pushing the metabolic pathway forward. They also saw reductions in SAH and SAM, other related metabolites, again, consistent with restoring the methionine cycle balance.
So it really looks like it's addressing the underlying biochemistry quite broadly, not just lowering one number.
Exactly. The authors argue these widespread metabolite changes point towards a more comprehensive restoration of the methionine cycle function that's impaired in HCU.
One potential issue. Could these people have just gotten much stricter with their diets during the trial, and maybe that caused the drop?
That's always a fair question in these kinds of studies. The paper did look into this. They monitored dietary protein intake and concluded that while there was some variation, as you'd expect, the major reductions in THC couldn't be explained by diet changes alone. The effect was attributed primarily to the drug.
Okay, that strengthens the findings considerably. So let's move into the discussion. What were the main conclusions the authors drew from all this?
The core message reinforced in the discussion is that pegtibatinase, especially at those 1.5 and 2.5 milligram kilogram doses, seems generally well tolerated and, frankly, highly effective at lowering THC and normalizing other related metabolites. And crucially, this was in adults who were already on standard therapy but still weren't adequately controlled.
So really hitting that unmet need we identified at the start.
Absolutely. They really emphasize the clinical significance of getting all participants in those high-dose cohorts below the 100 micromolar THC threshold. That's a major win in terms of potentially reducing the risk of those devastating long-term complications. The rapid and sustained nature of the response was also highlighted as very encouraging.
What about the potential impact beyond just lab numbers? Did they discuss quality of life or things like diet?
Yes, and this is potentially one of the most exciting aspects. That strict, lifelong, low-protein diet is a huge burden for people with HBCU. It impacts everything, and adherence is tough.
I can only imagine.
The paper points out that by effectively controlling the underlying metabolism, pegtibatinase might allow patients to liberalize their diet to eat more normal protein while still keeping their THCT and methionine in check.
That would be huge.
It really would. They mentioned that one participant, the one who got into the normal THCC range, was indeed able to increase their dietary protein under their doctor's guidance. If that holds true more broadly, it could dramatically improve quality of life and make managing the conditions so much easier.
A potential game changer on the daily living front. Okay, but every study has limits. What limitations did the authors acknowledge for this phase 12 trial?
They were upfront about several things. Firstly, the small cohort sizes. While necessary for early phase rare disease work, it means the results might be skewed by just one or two individuals. Using geometric means helps, but it's still a limitation.
Right.
Also, the study population, while meeting the criteria, might not represent the full spectrum of HCU patients out there, so you might not see every possible side effect or outcome.
Mm-hmm.
They also mention the slightly lower THC entry level for cohort 6. While the dose response was clear across all cohorts, it's possible that starting point contributed slightly to the strong results seen in that specific group.
And the study duration. 12 weeks isn't very long for a chronic condition.
Exactly. 12 weeks is great for seeing metabolic changes and short-term safety, but it's far too short to know if the treatment actually prevents blood clots or strokes or improves cognition long-term. Those clinical outcomes take much longer to assess.
So you can't claim clinical benefit yet, just biochemical improvement.
Correct. They also noted they didn't stratify the analysis by things like age at diagnosis or baseline disease severity, which might influence how well someone responds.
Okay. Understandable limitations for an early trial. So, pulling it all together, what's the final verdict from this composed study data?
The main conclusion is pretty clear. This study provides strong, compelling initial evidence that pegtibatinase is a very promising enzyme replacement therapy for HCU patients who have elevated THDC, say, above 50 micromolar, even if they're already on standard care.
Sounds like a potentially significant advance.
The authors frame it as a major milestone in HCU research. It offers hope for achieving a level of metabolic control that's often just not possible with the treatments we've had up to now.
So what happens next? How do they build on this and address those limitations?
They're already doing it. The paper mentions that larger, longer-term phase 3 trials are underway or planned. There's the Harmony study, which will enroll more participants, around 70, and follow them for 24 weeks.
Okay. Longer duration, more people.
Yep. And then there's the ENSEMBLE study, planned as an open-label trial for 52 weeks. Plus, participants from this COMPOSE study could continue in an open-label extension phase for up to 138 weeks.
Wow, so collecting much more long-term data.
Exactly. These larger, longer studies are crucial. They'll aim to confirm the safety profile, assess the durability of the THC reductions, and critically, start looking for actual impacts on clinical outcomes. Are patients having fewer complications? That's the ultimate goal.
So this phase 12 study really laid the groundwork, showing the biochemical potential and acceptable safety, setting the stage for those definitive trials.
That's a perfect summary. It provided the proof of concept needed to move forward with confidence. It's a really encouraging step for the HCU community.
It certainly sounds like it. Well, this has been a fascinating look at this research. Just to remind everyone, this discussion was based on an open access article published under a CC BY 4.0 license.
That's right. And if you want to read the original paper yourself, you can find the DOI and a link to the license details in the description for this episode.